Okay, here we go again. Anyone who wants to get enlightened, come in now. Don't blame me if you have to get reincarnated again and again and again. So, the first question. The only way to get people. How can we differentiate between expressing our truth and useless speech? And useless speech. My truth is useless speech. What's wrong with useless speech? All speech has some use somewhere. And sometimes it's just being kind to someone, just saying hello, making them feel good. And even like a joke. You know, people say, what are you doing talking about jokes, Ajahn Brahm? We should be more serious here. But you can see the power of humour. Makes people relax, makes people feel welcome. A lot of time humour has a deeper meaning. It's not useless at all, so most of our speech is not useless. It needs to be said. And sometimes even if people are saying something negative, they just need to vent, to let go of all their stuff. So they can say anything, and that's why you have two ears for, as I used to say, one to go in, one to go out. So if it really is useless speech, they need to say it, but you don't need to hear it. So let it go right the way through. If it's something really important, then put one hand over the ear so that you can actually keep it in. So that's speech. How can we tell the difference between wise discernment and avoidance? You want to say no to something. If you say no to something, people argue with you. So when people ask me, when are you coming to America the next time? Can we invite you back to Spirit Rock? I will never say no. Otherwise, you'll argue with me, twist my arm until I give in. So these days I say, I will think about it. And there were some invitations I've been thinking about for 10 years. That way I don't get into trouble and you don't argue with me. So don't say no, just say, I'll think about it. Because you think about it for years. What do you tell people who are scared to get sick? Sickness is wonderful. When you are sick, you don't have to go to work in the morning. You can lay in, you've got no stress. All these people visit you, you can eat food, which other times you can't eat. There was one of my friends, I went to see him in the hospice when he got cancer. Doctor gave up on him, and so he went to the hospice to die. And as soon as he got into the hospice, the people there said, what do you want to have for dinner tonight? And he said, well, I can't have this because I've got diabetes. I can't have that because high cholesterol. And the nurse said, what do you mean? You're dying of cancer, not of diabetes. You can eat whatever you want. I said, really? So he ate all the favorite food, oily, sweet, because it didn't matter anymore. So for the first time in years, he could eat something which his wife was always prohibiting. And because he was eating all of his favorite food, oily, sweet, syrupy, this is no joke, he got better. And they kicked him out of the hospice. Said, you don't need to be here anymore. There's a lot of interesting things about that. People keep eat health food and it kills you. But he did actually go back to the hospice six months later to die properly. But, you know, because he had a boost of happiness, eating stuff he liked, you know, he got well. So when you're sick, you can eat what you like, and you're dying anyway. People come and visit you, they bring all these flowers and stuff like that. So sometimes it's good to pretend to be sick, even if you're not. But oh, I feel sick this morning, God. I need a bit of TLC, a bit of kindness. And also, when you're sick in Buddhism, it means we're giving other people the opportunity to make good karma. So tell your partner, darling, I'm sick today. And the Buddha said, anyone who looks after the sick is like looking after the Buddha. So amazing good karma you can make, husband, by looking after me. Come on, pamper me. And it's absolutely true, because it's really fun. Now, if it's a relation, you look after them and you're kind to them. It's a really happy thing to do, to help people when they really need it. You get so much joy out of it. So sometimes when a person is sick, when you are sick, you're giving another person the opportunity to look after you. And that's very beautiful. There was this one monk. He visited his family in Chicago many years ago. And you know how cold and icy Chicago is. While he was walking down the street, he slipped over, he broke his leg. And so he was put in the ambulance, taken to hospital, put a cast on his leg. And then the word got to his mother that the son, the monk, had broken his leg. And as he told me, as soon as his mother came into the hospital ward and saw him in a plaster cast, having broken his leg, his mother smiled from ear to ear. Mom, what are you happy for? I've just broken my leg. Because, son, I've got you exactly where I want you for the next 2 weeks, and you can't run away to Thailand. Because for a mother, you just love mothering your children. And to get your kid, in hospital, when they're about 40 or 45, you've got them exactly where you want, and they can't escape. And that's beautiful, just being able to care for another. So being sick is giving other people a chance to express their love to you. What a wonderful gift that is, to be sick. As for me, it's very rare that I get sick. And I try not to get sick in public. The reason is, it's happened to me many times, I've coughed. And literally, in Perth, if I cough before the talk is finished, there's about 6 or 7 bottles of medicine in front of me. And they get sort of like, Western medicine. And the person gives it to me and says, you must take this, it's very good. I had a cough and it cured it. Then you've got some, say, Chinese medicine. And they say, this is even better, you must take this, please take it, it'll cure your cough. Then you've got Ayurvedic medicine, you've got homeopathic medicine, you've got herbal medicine. And everyone who gives it to me, they give it to me with such a beautiful smile. They say, look, I've just really gone out of my way to get it for you, can you please take it? And I end up promising to take all those medicines, and that really makes me sick. It's just sometimes being a monk like that, because people want to care for you. And if you don't need anything, it's really awful. So, look at me, I never wear socks. Even cold weather, even when I go to Europe in the wintertime, I don't wear socks. I've got really good circulation. Even when I was in the snow in college, I would just wear thongs and no socks on, because my feet are happy like this. You just know who I am. So when this lady knitted a pair of socks for me, and she gave them to me before the talk, of course I received them. I said, thank you so much. And then I wore them during the talk. I usually got my feet all covered up. And then during the talk, I was giving a talk, and I uncovered my foot, and I pointed it at her. And I saw her in the corner of my eye, turn around to her friend, he's wearing my socks! He's wearing my socks! That's like Dana. Somebody gives you the socks, you don't need them, but you wear them to celebrate kindness. So you give me medicine, I don't need it, but I'll eat it. Just to celebrate your kindness. And that's what makes me sick. But that's one of the things which I learned from the Dalai Lama. There's an old story, it's a nice story of Dana. This is when he was still in Tibet, apparently. He was going around Tibet from place to place, and there was a journalist, a US journalist, very smart guy, saw this famous person before he was really famous, and following him around Tibet as he went his rounds of the towns and villages. And he went to this one village, and all the people were lined up to give him things. And there was an obviously incredibly poor woman lined up, and the only thing he could give His Holiness the Dalai Lama was one of her skirts. And the anger had been boiling inside the reporter for days. And this was just, he couldn't hold it back any longer. He shouted at His Holiness the Dalai Lama, You think yourself a holy man, a spiritual man. You live in a palace. You get everything you ever want. And there's this poor woman, and she's giving you a skirt. You don't need a skirt. You're a man, for goodness sake. Why have you accepted a skirt from this poor woman? And no, in typical Buddhist fashion, His Holiness the Dalai Lama never defends himself, never just shouts back, but uses wisdom. And he told this reporter, it's true, I don't need the skirt, but the woman needed to give it to me. And that just taught me about the meaning of dana and generosity. I don't need socks, but that woman needed to give it to me. And so I take the socks, wear them once, wash them and give them to somebody else. So that's with dana. And that's with each one of you. If anyone gives you anything, even if you don't want it, you don't need it, accept it, wear it, taste it, and then give it to someone else who needs it more. But at least receive it first of all. Because one of the worst things is someone really goes out of their way to give you something. Then I don't want that. That is just destroying kindness, generosity, love. And that really, really is no good. So if anyone comes along and gives you something, please receive it. No matter what it is, you can always give it on to someone else. Because someone has really gone out of their way to care for you. So please receive it. Devachan Pram, are you the most exotic presenter to give voice at Spirit Rock? Question, one, you crack jokes. Two, you are self-effacing. I'm not self-effacing, I'm humble. I am the most humble. I have written to the Guinness Book of Records trying to get the entry as the most humble monk in the world. As I said yesterday, if you're humble, what's the point of being humble if no one knows about it? Self-effacing, speak Australian, good on you. So are we, your audience, more like you? Or like the somewhat tamer teachers that have previously occupied this podium? More importantly, as imitation is the most engaging sort of flattery, which aspects of your personality or practice would you be most pleased if we could imitate, and why? What I would like you all to imitate is my roundness. True. Too many people in America have the idea, you're already fat anyway, but they always have the idea that fat is bad for your health. Look. Now, one person, I know, this is a good example, Santa Claus. He's fat, he's happy, and what age is he? He was old when I was young. He must be 200, 300 years of age, yeah. Santa Claus, happy, fat, way to go. But seriously, I read this in a medical journal. And it's so obvious that when you are miserable, depressed, angry, guilty, your blood vessels contract. They get smaller. When you laugh, when you're happy, your blood vessels expand. They actually get bigger. Many studies, that's what happens. So if you are a little bit overweight, like many of you are, you've got a choice. Now this is your choice. You can either go on a diet, which sucks, or you can start laughing, which expands your blood vessels. I have been laughing and happy for such a long time. My blood vessels are now so wide, they're like super highways. So you can eat anything. Anything can go through here because it's so wide, nothing clogs up. But if you are fat and miserable and negative, never laugh, you've got lots of gut going through your blood vessels. The blood vessels are very small. You're going to die. And that answers one of the questions which you may have noticed. Why are fat people always happy and jolly? The reason is all the fat, miserable people died a long time ago.
Only the fat, happy ones are left.
Yeah, they've got extra cholesterol, but they've also got big arteries, so no problem. So you've got a choice, go on a diet or start laughing, otherwise you're dead. So not only do I teach the Dharma, I teach good health. Like how to be a vegetarian, eat a steak. Okay, very good. I don't know what other people do when they teach here, but there's sometimes that, you know, when you do break new ground, other people follow, and that's important. You know, you tell jokes, you make it funny, but you make it meaningful, tie it to daily life, tie it to your reality, and then the Dharma really takes off, it becomes really meaningful. And more importantly, your kids come. Which is, sometimes people keep on saying, in so many religions, there's only the old people here. Mm-hmm. You go to many churches, they're old. You know why? It's because they're going to die soon, they're just making sure they're going to go to heaven. When you're young, you've still got some time. But, you know, if you make it relevant and fun, your kids want to come as well. And I know many of you got kids, you know, and you really care about them, you say, why did you come to the temple, come to do meditation, come to listen to Dhamma? They say, no way. It's not fun. And you come here and you make it fun and enjoyable, they laugh and they want to come again. So this is actually why. This is a way of making the Dhamma relevant, fun. And then this is what happens, that more people get into the Dhamma. And as one Tibetan monk once taught me, he said, when people are laughing, because you told a joke, they've got their mouth open, and then you can put in the pill of Dharma. You've got to open their mouths, first of all. Your story about the monk who was invulnerable made me think of the moment an accident that happened to me. All the odds were against it, but when it happened, I let go. Things went white in my head, and I felt I was carried to a soft pillow. Was this like a spontaneous, deep, safe meditation? I had no scratch on my body. Very much so. You know what happens when kids fall from these 10-story buildings? And they don't know what's happening, so they don't tense up. They relax, and so basically they hardly get damaged. Uh-huh. But when we tense up, you know, when an accident happens, we become so fragile that, you know, a small little incident marks us, breaks bones, and goodness knows what else. There's also some psychic things happen there as well. There are many, many, many times when people just really relax and there is some weird stuff happens in this world, and this is sometimes what happens. If you can really, really let go, you happen to let go. That was the brilliant thing to do. You let go, you relax. If you die, you die. If you live, you live. And then when you have that sort of attitude, the chances are you're going to live. You survive. It's amazing some of the things which happen. So yeah, true. How to behave if people are being mean to you? Calm or speak truth firmly. It depends who they are. If it's some big guy in Oakland, I wouldn't try and speak firmly. I'd try to get out of there as soon as possible. Apparently, Oakland is the murder capital of the Bay Area.
No.
No.
Richmond.
Richmond. Spirit Rock. Look, this is one of my stories. It was... we were doing an opening of my new centre in Perth one day, many years ago. And I was number two monk. I was given the job of ordering all the chairs, the marquee, and we managed to get the governor of the state to come to our opening. For Buddhists, that was incredible. We managed to get him to come. So I was told by all of our supporters, even by our treasurer, don't worry about the bills, we'll find that anywhere. Ajahn Brahm, you order the very best chairs, marquee and everything else for our guests, for a big event. So I did the order, and when the truck came with all the chairs and the marquee, I was helping somebody else. I didn't see them unload. That was my mistake. And when they did unload, and I checked it, the truck had already gone. And when I checked, the marquee was filthy. But that's okay, we could hose it down. The chairs were all dirty too. We could wipe them down. We had about a dozen chairs for the VIPs, including the governor and his wife, and politicians and mayors and stuff like that. And absolutely true, not one of those chairs had legs the same length. They all wobbled. And that was it. I couldn't sort of stand that, so I got on the telephone and rang the company. And I managed to get the manager just before she closed the office and left on a Friday afternoon. And when I told her the problem, she said, okay, we'll fix it. What I didn't realize was all the workers, they'd left work for the weekend and gone down to the pub, the bar. A few drinks before they finished the weekend. And what had happened, the manager had come in, guys, go back to work. The Buddhists need their chairs changed. Now, Australia is pretty much the same as maybe Texas. These men were not happy. They were really angry. And so when the truck came with the new chairs, now the truck was maybe 100 metres, about 300 feet from the destination, when one of the guys jumped out of the cab and came running towards me. Where's the bloke in charge? I want the man in charge. He was shouting with his fist clenched. So I went right up to him and said, I am the bloke in charge. And he put his fist right in front of my nose with big angry eyes. And he could smell the alcohol on his breath. In all my years as a monk, that's the most alcohol that I've ever taken in. And he had his fist, he was ready to flatten me. He was a big guy. You know what I did? It is natural because of my training. I just relaxed. It was peaceful. And I just looked him in the eye. No fear, no anger, no justification. Just looked at him. And it was a wonderful moment because I knew I had 100% control over that guy. He couldn't move, he couldn't do anything, because in a fight, you know, you need foreplay. You know, somebody has to say, yeah, you, and then the fight starts. Now, knowing that psychology, he just had his fist here and I didn't do the next response. I was just peaceful, standing, and he couldn't move. And I had him there for about maybe a minute, just looking at me, and I realised he didn't know what to do next. And I enjoyed that power. And in the time it took the truck to park and one of the other guys to walk over, he put his hand over this man's shoulder, come on, let's unload the chairs. And I said, yes, I'll help you. And that was it. It was an amazing just situation of how I should to deal with violence. Because the fellow was so angry and was ready to really hit me. And he was had alcohol and he wasn't really in command of his senses. But it's amazing when you give peace to someone who's violent, they can't do anything. You are invulnerable. So that's, but please don't try that. But you can know what's possible. A lot of time, people actually being mean to you, be calm or speak truth firmly. If speaking has any purpose, if that can really help, then do it. A lot of time they're so angry, so mean, that they're not really listening to what you say. They just want to hurt you. So another way is get out your smartphone and video them. Or get someone else to video them when they're being mean to you. That's especially good if it's your partner. Because when they are calmed down and peaceful, then replay it to them. It's like mindfulness. Because at the time, they're not really aware of what they're doing and how they're affecting you. So if you can somehow record it, and when they're in a good space, play it back to them so they see what they look like when they're being mean. It will give them a chance for reflection, and maybe that's enough for them to do something about their anger habit. Because a lot of time when we get angry, we don't know what we're doing. I ask people like that if they've got a partner or a parent who's abusive, who gets drunk or has some other addiction, they don't realize how they behave when they're drunk. So if you can somehow take a video of them, and when they're sober, when they're in a good space, show it to them. Darling, this is what you look like and how you behave when you're drunk. It's a way of practicing mindfulness that they can see themselves at a later time and reflect, is that the sort of person I want to be? They know it's a problem then. So that can actually be quite effective. And if they won't stop the drinking, then you can post it on YouTube. In any moment, if the karma we create may not show up until many, many, many lives later, and what's happened to us in a moment may be the result of cumulative past karmic action from hundreds of lives ago, it seems there's no point in labelling anything as good, bad, or trying to understand why the moment is the way it is, because overlapping karmic causes are so complex and obscure, we'll never truly know why something happens. It's true. You never know why something is happening. And anyway, that's wasting time. Instead of why this is happening to me, the question should be, what are you doing about it? Because it's the karma of the present is the most important in Buddhism. The karma from the past is called the ingredients you have to use to make your meal. And you don't always have the best ingredients. But it doesn't matter what ingredients you have, you can always make a delicious meal. That is my simile of the two people baking a cake. The first person baking a cake has old white flour, chemically enhanced. They have white diabetically enhanced sugar, cholesterol enhanced butter. And they have fruit, which is so old, it could be used in the guns of Marines. It's so hard. And they've got this old kitchen to cook it in. They've got the very worst ingredients. The second person has got the very best ingredients you could possibly have. You know, organically grown whole wheat, free-range wheat. I saw this sign, free-range carrots. What does that mean? They have got beautiful honey from Australia. Delicious fresh fruit from California. And they've got canola oil or something. It's supposed to be, cholesterol-free. And they've got this fantastic kitchen made by Google. You just have to press a button, it cooks itself. Sorry, here's my word. And the question is, which person bakes the most delicious cake? Because it's not always a person with the best ingredients. It's what you do with what you've got is more important than the ingredients. So sometimes, and actually more often than not, people with the worst ingredients make the most delicious cake. Because they put more effort, more love, more care into their cooking. So that is the law of karma. Your karma from your past gives you the ingredients of right now. You know, you may be not the most beautiful, you know, maybe not the smartest, maybe the not fittest person in the world. You may have this disability and that disability, but what are you doing with what you've got? And even if you've got some very poor ingredients, you can make an incredible cake out of that by realizing the karma of the present is more important than the karma of the past. So instead of saying, why is this happening to me? What did I do to deserve this? That is just too difficult to find out. But what is more important is, what are you doing with what you've got? There's always something you can do. You know, with no matter what you have to deal with in life. And you know these incredible people, Nelson Mandela's, 26 years in prison. What did he do with that? That was really bad ingredients. But he made that into this incredible, powerful person. You've got people with disabilities, people who born into poverty, people who got these terrible illnesses. And they make incredible, powerful people out of themselves. I remember seeing this video, a motivational video of this guy. He's a US citizen who's got no legs and no arms. Have you seen that one? He picks himself up by the telephone. He's got nothing, but what an incredible person that is. No arms, no legs, but he's made a beautiful cake out of what he has got. Now that is the law of karma. So it's not what we've got, so don't complain about what you've got to work with in life. Get cooking. What words could you offer to a situation that involves greatly hurting and disappointing loved ones for the sake of following your heart and truth? For example, leaving your marriage not because it is bad but because it feels wrong and no one can understand or respect that this is something you must do. So if there's a thing like that, kind of leaving the marriage or staying in the marriage, too many people, mostly women but men as well, they stay in the marriage for the sake of somebody else. They're sacrifices. But please remember that you count as well. That is why when I do a marriage blessing, to get it right from the very beginning, I look in the eyes, somebody mentioned this earlier, I look in the eyes of the wife, first of all, the bride, and say, now you're a married woman, you must never think of yourself from this time on. And she nods and smiles, yes. Look in the eye of the guy, from now on you're a married man, you must not think of yourself. This is anecdotal, but this is true. I've done many marriages. He always pauses before he agrees. True, you know. But he agrees. Yeah, I'm not going to think of myself. And then still looking at the guy, I said, from this moment on, you're a married man, you must not think of her, your wife. And I look at her and say, from this moment on, you must not think of him, your husband. Now, many of you are quiet now because you haven't got a clue what this crazy mug is on about. And confusion gets people's attention. It's a great teaching trick. So the answer is, looking at both of them, we're really confused. I say, from this moment on, you must not think of yourself and you must not think of your partner. From this moment on, you must only think of us. And they get it. Us. If you're only thinking of yourself, it's selfish. That's not a relationship. That's not a marriage. If you're always thinking of the other person, you get burnt out sooner or later. You're just giving, giving, giving. You're not in the marriage. It's about the other person. And the solution is, in a marriage, in any relationship, it's not about me or him or her. It's about us. That's what a marriage is all about. It's us. So you don't think of her. You don't think of him, you don't think of me, you only think of us. So if there's any problem, whose problem is it? Our problem! Not his problem, God, men. Not her problem, women. Not my problem, I'm hopeless. It's our problem. It's amazing how many solutions you can find when it's our problem, not his or my problem or her problem. So remember, whoever wrote this, you count too. The best thing if you can discuss it together, you know, with your partner. It's our problem, I'm not happy. But if that's gone past that point, it's not my problem. Then, leaving your marriage will hurt. But you know, it's like taking the tooth out. It hurts, but sometimes staying in hurts more. So you find out what you can do because you count too. Here's one of my stories from the Dung Book. And I told this over in Sacramento in front of a bishop from the Anglican Church. And he got the wrong answer. But he understood what the answer was and said, wow, this is good. This is a story of the seven monks meditating on loving kindness in a cave. It's based on a story of Taraputta Thera, a bhikkhu who was an arahat in the time of the Buddha, but has many differences, but it's based on the story. There were seven monks meditating on loving kindness. May all beings, without exception, be happy and well. And in this cave, in the jungle, these were the seven monks. Now listen carefully because I'm going to ask you a question about this. The seven monks were the head monk. His brother was number two. The best friend, these were all monks, were number three. The fourth monk was like the enemy. They never really got on together. Just like some monks don't get on with me.
because I'd only be coonies, but leave that alone. So we're still mugs, we still respect each other. So, you know. But sometimes you get upset with people. So the fourth monk was the enemy. They had a personality clash. They saw things in a different way, but they were monks together anyway. So the fourth monk was the enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so old that he could die any day. And the next monk was a very ill monk. And his disease, his sickness, was so advanced that no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. They were both next to death. And the last monk was the useless monk. Whenever he tried to meditate, he'd fall fast asleep and start snoring. Whenever they did any chanting, it was always out of key, and he could never keep his robe on properly. Oops. And I say every monastery, whether it's for monks or nuns, always has one. The useless monk or the useless bhikkhu. If you haven't got one yet, IOT, you'll find one. So there they were, the seven monks. And this band of thieves, this robber gang, found the cave in the jungle. And they thought, this is the place for us. When we do all our robbery and stealing, we can hide all the goods here until the heat goes down. We can also stay away here. The police will never find us in here. This is a perfect hideout for us. But these monks found it first. So the head of the thieves wanted to kill all the monks and take over the cave. But the head monk, it's amazing, head monks and head nuns, we're really good talkers. We can talk you into writing out these checks you can't afford. We can talk you into making these pledges. And this monk taught the head of the gang of thieves to let everybody go except one. Because the head of the gang of thieves, well, I'll let you all go. Who knows, you may tell the police. But if I keep one of you guys and I kill you in front of everybody else, that shows how serious we are. That all the monks we set free, you will know. If you tell the police, we will find you, and this is what happens to you. And that was the best deal the head monk could make. One would have to be sacrificed so all the rest of the monks could go off for free. And it was the head monk's choice who would be chosen. Now, imagine you were the head monk. Who would you choose? Before you answer, I'll go through the list of monks again. The head monk, his brother, his best friend, who would do anything for him, the enemy, who he didn't like, caused a lot of strife for him, the old monk, who could die any day, same with the sick monk, they were both next to death, or the useless monk, who'd never done any good karma for anybody. So which, if you're the head monk, who would you choose?
Head monk.
If you think it was the head monk himself, please put your hand up. Have the courage of convictions. You were all wrong. That's what the bishop said. The bishop said he sacrificed himself. That is the wrong answer. Any other suggestions?
No.
The useless monk?
Best friend.
Best friend, no.
No one.
No one. Yeah, that's the right answer. The right answer is he could not choose. His love. Remember, they're doing loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well without any discrimination. His love towards his best friend was exactly the same, not an inch more, an inch less than his love towards his brother. Even the old monk and sick monk, even though about to die, he loved them no more than his best friend. What was the other one? The enemy, he loved him, and the useless monk as well. Most importantly, himself, yeah, no more, no less than anybody else. And when I told this to the bishop, I reminded him, Christian Bible, what Jesus Christ said, to love your neighbor as yourself. It didn't say love your neighbor more than yourself, not less than yourself, but to love yourself as your neighbor. So the love was so even, he told the head of the thieves, I can't choose. I love everybody, including myself, equally. And the problem is that most people, you're taught, conditioned to sacrifice yourself. You don't love yourself as much as others, and that's a big problem. That's one of the reasons why relationships fail. You sacrifice, you don't love and care for yourself enough. You don't love yourself more than your partner, not less than your partner. You're in it equally. And of course people ask, yeah, but what happened next? And this is why I say it's based on Thaliputra's story. Because when the head monk told the thieves he couldn't choose and explained why he couldn't choose, the head of the thieves was so impressed, as people are, that he not only just let all the monks go, but became a monk himself. And so did a few of the other thieves, and the rest of the thieves went back to the village and got proper jobs. Because wisdom actually inspires people. That's not just making it up, I can see why that would work. When you get really, really inspired, you think, wow, there is actually goodness and there's truth in this world. And then you want to find more of it. But the main point of telling that story is how many people in a land like United States always sacrifice themselves and the psychological damage that does. Please love yourself and care for yourself no more, no less than anyone else. You count. And hopefully that would answer the question. How to behave if very frightened. I was living in Thailand, in the jungles. And in the jungles, many animals and insects think of you as their dinner. Tigers, bears and elephants. Now, when I would tell the villagers about going off into the jungles to meditate, they would actually say, oh, we never heard of a monk being eaten by a tiger. And I replied to them, of course you wouldn't hear about it. The monk wouldn't live to tell the tale. So I didn't believe that. Tigers eat people. So when I was meditating in the jungle one night, just out in the jungle, no protection, really dark, in the I was used to the jungle by this time. So I knew that snakes wouldn't bother you if you didn't bother them. But the trouble was elephants and tigers. I was told if a baby elephant came up, you'd always hit it on the top of the trunk. If you didn't hit it, it would play with you. And if you, it would play with you, but then the mother would come up and get afraid. So you had to chase the baby elephants away. Otherwise, you know, the mother would get too scared. You know, just give it a little knock on the trunk. That's sensitive. You know, it would just go away. It wouldn't really hurt it, but you'd actually be saving your own life. But when it came to tigers, they'd always say, don't run. As long as you face a tiger, eye to eye, they won't attack you. That's what they said. So when I was there, meditating, it was really peaceful, very calm at night time. But then I heard this sound of an animal coming towards me, a jungle animal. Straight away, you've got your eyes closed. If you open your eyes, you can't see anyway, it's dark. So I just used my mindfulness and listened to the sound very carefully. Yeah, it was coming in my direction, but it didn't sound like a big animal, just a small animal. So no worries. I went back to my meditation, watching my breath. And then it came closer, and the noise was louder. So I realized, you know, I had experience of these animals. I thought it was what's called a civet cat. These little cats, quite harmless, just going through the jungle looking for something to eat. So again, not dangerous. So I just closed my eyes and carried on meditating, forgot about the sound. But then it came even closer. And you could tell by the way it was cracking the twigs. This was not a small animal, this was a big animal. And straight away I thought it was tiger. And I listened really carefully. And by the sound of the twigs being crushed in the forest as it came closer towards me, this was a big tiger. I was in trouble. So straight away I opened my eyes, I had a flashlight. And I used my flashlight, I searched for it, and I saw it. It was a tiny mouse about this big. And that's a true story. And it was fear. Fear had actually bent my... I really thought I was being mindful. When fear and mindfulness come together, it exaggerates things. It does make a little mouse sound. I was mindful, I was listening very carefully. That sounded like a tiger. Because fear had amplified the sound. And from that time on, I always worry about whenever you're afraid, you are not really being truly mindful. What's coming into your ears and eyes and senses is being exaggerated, mostly out of all proportion. So that's the first thing to know. When you're frightened, you're not seeing things truthfully. You're exaggerating things. And number two, when you're frightened, you've got a choice. If there's something to do, then do it. If there's nothing to do, you can't do anything, so what are you being afraid of? This is one of the things which the Dalai Lama said, worry. If you worry about something, is it going to help at all? Is it going to do anything? If your worry is going to help you, then worry. And if you can't do anything, what's the point of worrying? Just let it happen. So this is one of the things with fear. When we exaggerate and we go off into the future with fear, exaggerating. I learned when I was a kid, because I was having to go to the dentist when I was about 6-7 years of age. And in those days, this was in the, still the late 50s. Dentists in those days, the drills, they just actually used the hand drills to just, well, it's actually much better than that, but not that much better. Old machines and any injections. Now, these needles they'd use over and over and over again. Now, they were blunt by the time they got to use. And these days, dentists, they don't hurt at all. Not compared to the old days. And going to the dentist, you were right to be scared. It was like just going to Guantanamo Bay. You're like torture chamber, all these machines and stuff, and the drills made all this grinding noise. It was scary, especially for a kid. So when my mum told me, tomorrow you have to go to the dentist, you don't have to go to school, I was terrified. And I told my mum, I'm not going to the dentist. She said, you have to. But I don't want to. But you must. And I threw a tantrum, started crying. And I was scared all night, never slept well. And I started thinking in the morning, how can I get out of this? And I tried using what I knew of psychology. When I woke up, I told my mum, you don't love me. Because if you loved me, you wouldn't be sending me to be tortured. And my mum said, I do love you, darling, but why are you sending me to the dentist? Because I love you. I don't believe it. And so she literally dragged me to the dentist, kicking and screaming. I was so upset and so afraid. And when we got to the dentist surgery, it's only then that I found out my appointment was cancelled because the dentist was sick. They didn't have SMSs in those days. But I learned a lesson there. All that worry, all that fear, and it never happened. So this, from these days on, you know, you don't get frightened until it actually happens. And by then it's too late. So you don't worry about things. So that's how I deal with fear. Fear itself is a problem. Not what you're afraid of. Good morning, keep on going. Look, they say the scariest thing in life is giving public talks. I do that all the time. I'm not afraid of that. You know how I overcame fear of public talks? By deciding to have a good time. I'm going to enjoy myself. I don't care whether you like it or not. I'm going to enjoy it. When you enjoy yourself, you can't be afraid. Because joy and fear can't coexist. So if you go to the dentist, enjoy it, have fun. Exactly. You know, they're really comfortable chairs. That's the most comfortable chair I've ever... You know, you can recline this way and that way. Oh, it's really, really soft. I would really like to get one of those to meditate on. Oh, it's so nice. And for those of you, sometimes you ask the question in meditation, I've got lots of saliva, what should I do? Those dentist things. On a retreat, if you have trouble with saliva, get one of those things. don't have any trouble with saliva when you're meditating. So you have fun with a dentist and have good trust. Anyway, a recent poll said college students are 40% less empathetic than older generations. Will you consider speaking at campuses? No, I don't care about college students. I've got no empathy for those people. Like, come on, give me a break. You can't speak everywhere. People ask me to speak at these colleges, at Lawrence Livermore College, because they've got a great supercomputer there. Want to speak everywhere at Congress? Crikey. I will never have any sleep at night, not even during the daytime. So, you go and speak. That comes in. You know all the jokes. See, you know that. No, I just do too much. Can you speak regarding dealing with aversion? No, I don't like problems. Just, if you really have to, then just do it. But if you don't have to, then you can get out of it. Get out of it. But you know what you're averse to anyway. Some people are averse and get upset at going to work. They're averse to their boss, averse to the stress. But think about it. Why do they pay you? Your salary is a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. If you really enjoyed your work, don't tell your boss. Otherwise, he could reduce your salary and you still go. So you only do this, you know, your work, because you know, you're being paid for it. That's a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. So that's one of the reasons why, yeah, aversion is part of life. Sometimes, you know, you have to do it, so whatever you are averse to or afraid to, make fun with it. You've got to do it anyway. So make fun about it. Go and have a wonderful time at work. And by having a wonderful time, do things differently, not always the same. Make fun. Make joy in whatever you do. That's why you go to work wearing strange clothes. Guys, go and wear a skirt to work. That will really stir people up. Girls, wear a red nose. Shave your hair when you go to work. And you say, what have you got a bald head for? I've just been on this meditation retreat. That really stir them up. Make a bit of fun and games with whatever you do. And when you create happiness, you know, just like that guy Patch Adams, he became lovable. You know, and everybody got so inspired going to work, not knowing what this doctor was going to do next. And the therapeutic value of having a bit of fun and games was enormous. Now, when I was at Cambridge, theoretical physics, I was taught to play around, whether it's with the equations, doing experimental work, play around with the machinery, with the devices, play. Because they always told me that when you play, you bust many machines, but out of 100 times you play around and get nowhere, one time you make the discovery which gives the Nobel Prize through playing around. That playfulness is so important in life. You play around, you make so many mistakes, but the one invention, the one new way of doing things you discover creates huge amount of wealth for the company you work for and for yourself. And in meditation, playing around, trying it different ways, will make happiness and progress. For example, about playing around with meditation. I already mentioned the zombie meditation. When you do walking meditation, many of you, have you done walking meditation before? Mm-hmm. Basically, you know what I'm talking about. What do you normally do? You know, you start in one end, I don't know where you put your hands, you walk from one end to the other, turn around, walk back again. After a while, that gets quite boring. So in Australia, I said Buddhism has to adapt to the local culture. So, you know, we have American Buddhism, now we have Australian Buddhism. We have Australian walking meditation. So you start at one end, your feet together, your hands like this, and you hop to the other end. It's kangaroo walking meditation. You turn around and you hop back. And everybody who does that, slot on top and goes, they laugh, and everyone who sees them laughs, and they get this big boost of energy and happiness, and the meditation takes off. Kangaroo walking meditation. What other way can you do over here? What's your local animal over here? Skunk meditation? I don't know. Bear. How does a bear walk?
Cougar.
Cougar. How does a cougar walk? So on all fours. Right hand, left hand, lifting the right hand. Because doing it slightly differently creates energy, awareness, fun, and your meditation takes off. Don't do it in the same old boring way. Could you choose a book of yours for me? That's beginners. I can choose one of your books for me, your checkbook. But you must, I signed your books, you must sign your book before you give it to me. Humour, ego, ego, humour. Ego, she, go, we must all go. Yet sometimes, please don't confuse confidence with ego. Because I'm a very confident monk. But, you know, sometimes when I disappear from here, I disappear. You don't know I've been. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if another person suffers from neurosis and defilements, and your behaviour of loving yourself hurts them due to their attachment, clinging, controlling, isn't their pain the issue to work through? How do you decide to break from their control of you, even if no violence abuse is involved, when they call you selfish for doing so? But sometimes you have to make your decision no matter what other people say. Because if you always listen to other people, this is one of the other faults of people in places like the US, Europe, Australia, is we're so in control of what other people, we're so controlled by what other people think of us and say about us. So much so we spend all our lives trying to please somebody else, trying to get praise, trying to be liked, instead of just trying to be ourselves. So sometimes I ask myself, now, am I doing this to please other people? And I do this because I have fun. And if you all walk out, fine, I just go back and have a rest. I don't care. So I make sure I don't care what other people think of me. Which is why I dress like this. Honestly. When I first went to Perth 32 years ago, this young, she's about 11, 12 year olds, came up to me. She put her hands on her hips like this. And said to me, looked me up and down with utter disgust, and said to me, "You are dressed like a girl. That's sick." She tried to really upset me. And I just thought it was so funny, I burst out laughing. And that really upset her even more. Because I don't worry what other people think of me. Now, even ordaining bhikkhunis, I don't care what other people think of me, because you know yourself what you're doing. So it doesn't matter what other people say. This is how I was taught by Ajahn Chah. In Thailand, the worst thing they could call you is a dog. And he told me, if anyone calls you a dog, don't get angry at them. If someone calls you a dog, look at your bottom to see if you have a tail. If you haven't a tail, you're not a dog, no more problem. So if anyone calls you're sick, you're a pervert, you're selfish, have a look to see if you deserve that word. If you do deserve it, say thank you for pointing that out. Most of the time you won't deserve it at all. So it's not a problem. No matter what people say at you, if they call you a dog, see if you've got a tail. No tail, no problem. So you don't just believe what other people say. You know when someone calls you an idiot, why you get upset? Because you think they may be right. If you were absolutely perfectly confident they were wrong, would you get upset? It's only when you think they are right that people's comments about you have any traction. When you really are confident, you know who you are, why you do things, then people make those comments, it's like water on a lotus leaf. I always like this simile in Buddhism of a lotus leaf. You can urinate on a lotus leaf, and when the urine all drips off, it leaves no smell. You can pour the most expensive perfume on a lotus leaf. That all drops off and also leaves no residue. A wise person is like a lotus leaf. Praise and blame, other people's comments, they just go off you like a lotus leaf, leaving no residue. That's a very beautiful simile. Praise, blame, what other people say about you, they don't know who you are, why you do things. You could be a fraud. I'm the only one who knows I'm a fraud. I could be really wise. I'm the only one who knows that. You can't know that. So what do you say? Like, piss off a lotus leaf. Like Chanel number 5. Off a lotus leaf. Either way, it leaves no residue. That's how to behave. Do you want to do some meditation or some more questions?
Meditation.
Okay, very good. So, okay, let's just have just a quick 10-minute break. If you really need to go to the toilet, go. If you don't, just stand up and do some exercises just to relax.
What do you do on Google?
I don't know.
Is it an interview?
Yeah, go and give a talk there. Visit the place. Okay, so when you're ready, please sit down. What time do I have to finish?
Tomorrow.
Nine.
Tomorrow? Nine?
Five.
Six?
Five.
5 a.m. 5 a.m.
It's just the beginning.
Okay, we'll do half an hour? And then it gives time for a couple of more questions before we finish off. You don't sit cross-legged, you can put your feet out if you want to. You know, in most meditation centers, the best seats are next to the wall. So you can lean back and put your feet out. Those are the ones which usually get taken up first of all. Okay, so here we go. Meditation or bust. Last chance for enlightenment. No, it's not. Here we go. 4:30. So, da-da-da. Now close your eyes. And be aware of your body. Everything I've ever taught you, just forget about. It's just a bunch of gomayon. The future is also gomayon. The only real truth is right now. So just be here. Now minutes past now, on the ninth day of the ninth month, 2000 and now. That's the time. And we're located in Heer Retreat Center, in Heer County, in the state of Heer, in the Federation of United States of Heer. Planet Heer. Universe here. And
just let everything settle down. Don't try and make this moment peaceful. Let it become peaceful. When you hear the sound of the car, just let that come in to your heart. You can feel your body, probably tired after a long day. Don't try and get rid of that tiredness. Opening the door of your heart to this experience, no matter what it is. So what are you experiencing right now? Please give this importance. Whatever it is, without judging good or bad, it should be this, it should be something else. Give this moment importance. Care for it. And you'll find you are letting things be. You may go through sloth and torpor, but that's fine, that is part of the path. Just be peaceful. Let the mind become still by just being a silent observer, a passenger, not a driver, of your meditation. Look at your mind like a friend. Don't look at your mind like a slave you can order around. So no controlling. Just being aware. And being kind. Imagine that you are the Buddha meditating. The Buddha so compassionate, so kind, so friendly. We just let the mind be.
want anything. The waves on the lake get less and less. When you don't do anything, the energy starts to go into awareness, into the knowing, rather than the doing. Be patient, and the mind wakes up. Things become still, they vanish. If you have thoughts, imagine the thoughts are in front of you, maybe 2 feet in front, and you are 2 feet behind, just watching them. When you don't go inside the thoughts, it's like putting my hand at the end of the arm. I get perspective. I don't get involved, sucked into the thoughts. Then I can just let them go. I can imagine your mind resting on a pillow. No pressure, no asking it to do something. Just resting. You feel all the stress of having to solve problems, having to do things, and to change things, all the business of your mental world being put aside for a few minutes. Not trying to improve yourself. Take it from me, you are good enough already. More than good enough. So just be and celebrate just being. you feeling? How has your mind calmed down? The waves on the surface of your lake, are they peaceful now? Remember, this is good enough. This moment is all you have. Please open the door of your heart and love this moment. The treasure is right where you are now. Let the arrow of wanting go. To end the meditation, please take in a deep in-breath, and on the out-breath, open your eyes. And smile. I'm going to answer a couple of these questions from the middle, just in case. Oh, good. A question on meditation. I meditate in a very comfortable couch. After a few hours, although I was not asleep, I feel as if I slept for this time without jhana or nimitta. Being too comfortable about the meditation? No, it's not. How can you shut up Eddie for talking too much? Lots of love. Who's Eddie? Anyway, don't try to shut up Eddie for talking too much. That's the nature of Eddie, whoever that poor person is.
Talking about Eddie in Perth.
Sorry?
Eddie in Perth.
Oh, that Eddie in Perth. That's his nature. You love these people. I didn't realise it's a thing. But if you are meditating on a couch and you go into a dull state, it means you needed that dull state. It means you were tired. So, if you've got svatan torpor, it's a good thing, as I said. In the sutras, I told a story yesterday. The Buddha was going with Ananda through the forest. He saw a monk sitting in perfect posture, full lotus, right hand over the left hand, thumb slightly touching, back straight, chin in. So still. And the Buddha turned to his attendant Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. 2 weeks later, that monk had disrobed. He was control freak. Same sutra, the Buddha went deep into the forest, and there he saw another monk who was nodding with sloth and torpor. And the Buddha smiled to his attendant Ananda, I'm not worried about him. And 2 weeks later, that monk was fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. So, if that's you nodding, just give it 2 more weeks. Because the second monk was letting go. Yeah, it was sleepy, but the sleepiness would soon disappear. How do you sleep? Why is sleep deprivation in monastic life wholesome and being kind to the body? It's not. It's a big mistake. What suggestions do you have for calming my restless mind that wakes me from sleep?
is actually doing a resolution before you go to sleep. So you tuck yourself into your bed, make yourself comfortable. When you're still awake, before you fall asleep, tell yourself, I will have a peaceful sleep, I will have a peaceful sleep, I will have a peaceful sleep. Or make any suggestion you want in the sleep. Now may I, wake up with a calm mind, may I wake up with a calm mind, may I wake up with a calm mind. You'll be quite surprised, those suggestions you put into your mind after you've tucked yourself into bed, when you relax before you go to sleep, have a huge impact on your sleep. If somebody has nightmares, you say, may I have peaceful dreams, may I have peaceful dreams, may I have peaceful dreams. And you say that to yourself very simply, in your own words, pay full attention. After you've said that, just relax, let it go, forget about it, and go asleep. Because you find that does have a huge impact. Auto-suggestion, hypnosis, conditioning. You make use of that, and it solves these sorts of problems. But sleep deprivation in monastic life, I don't do that anymore. That was a big mistake. You sleep how much you need to sleep, not too much, not too little. You find your own middle way. And there are times of your life you need a lot of sleep. You know, I listen to my body. A lot of times I ask my body, body, how are you? Do you need to sleep? And there are sometimes it's weird. Sometimes I've had a nice good night's sleep and I'm busy in the morning or meditating and I ask my body and my body tells me, go to bed, take a nap. And I can't figure out why it's telling me that, but I follow that advice. I take a nap and usually if my body's telling me that, I hit the pillow and I go into a deep sleep pretty quickly and I wake up maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, really refreshed. And I figured this out, this is like some sickness, some illness about to hit me, a cold, a flu or something. And my body knows, and it tells me, take a rest. And that way I don't have sicknesses. It's been a long time since I've been ill. Other monks get flus and stuff, but I don't think to get them. Because I listen to my body, and I heed its advice. And I can do that any time, the morning, the afternoon, night time. I feel I need a rest. I'll take it, only for a short time, and afterwards you feel so good. So sleep deprivation, having some idea of how many hours you are supposed to sleep, is absolutely stupid. You ask your body, how much do you need to sleep, body? And your body gives that answer. Sometimes it's a little amount, sometimes it's a lot. But your body knows much better than you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, we can't disrobe after marriage. Should lay people wait to get married after they are more free from defilements or find a partner where there is true and reciprocal unconditional love? You know this is like life. You know when you're first, when you're really young, you find someone you think you like, you know, you get committed to them, you make mistakes, you've got to learn. And I tell young people, you can't really find love until you've broken your heart a couple of times. You know, until you've actually felt what love is really like. But you do that in life. And yeah, you find this partner, that partner. After a while, if you become a monk or a nun, you love everybody. Which is the best. But you have to give it a try. And look, doesn't matter how many times you've been hurt, never put your heart in a concrete bunker. Yes, you don't get hurt anymore, but you don't have any feeling at all. So just give love a chance. If it works, fine. If it don't work, you learnt a lot. Is truckload of dung karma you deserve or other person delivering bad karma? You don't know why. You know, in that story, the truckload of dung, you know, you go back home after this wonderful afternoon and you find a big truckload of shit in front of your house. You didn't order it. You don't know why it's there. But there it is. So this is the point of that simile, you're trying to figure out who delivered it, why it came to you, why me? That is wasting time. Just instead of complaining, get out the wheelbarrow, the shovel, the spade, go and take it to the back of your garden and dig it in. Blaming others is wasting time. Get digging. I have a difficult time distinguishing letting things go with letting myself off the hook. When letting myself off the hook may not be the responsible, wise choice during times of difficulty. Can you speak to this? Please, let yourself off the hook. Be irresponsible. you want to have fun. We are so damn responsible. We're responsible for our partner, for our kids. We're responsible for the government, for the climate. We're responsible for everything. No wonder you guys are stressed out. Yeah, it's good to be responsible some time of the day. But it's also good to be irresponsible a lot of the day. Irresponsibility rocks. It's true, isn't it? Tell us about the difference in a mindfulness practice in Western Australia versus the USA. Is it more fun in Australia? What? Have you ever seen these people? Don't laugh, be mindful. Stop smiling, you're not mindful. And mindfulness becomes this other control mechanism. I've got to be mindful. And you're paranoid about not being mindful. Mindfulness becomes forced, contrived, unnatural. Mindfulness is a natural state.